Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the magazine of free minds and free markets and active verbs. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and a tide-rolling Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, pals.
Roll tide. Mm.
Hey, Matt.
I would say happy Monday, but it's not a very happy Monday.
Oh, Eeyore. Will you never lose or win or something?
That's not Eeyore's problem.
Yes.
Catherine, you're not going to use this as your what you've been consuming in the cultural arena because you don't follow instructions, but you did attend a sports ball, and I want you to attempt in 30 seconds or less to describe it using your own words.
It was amazing. I went to see the University of Alabama play the football this weekend. Couple of major observations. One, I learned what a Razorback is, since that's who we were playing.
Oh,
and
two,
I now will be exclusively greeting people with the phrase Roll Tide, which was the only signature sign-off greeting that occurred the entire time I was there. The game itself was really good for a kind of game that you go to because they were mostly winning and then a moment of danger and then they won anyway, which is the correct arc of a football game that you experience in person. It was great. I had a great time. Roll Tide.
Is a Razorback the new model from Gillette?
It's got 18 blades. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. There was actually, Peter, a bad, I think it was a Spider-Man villain named the Razorback in Marvel Comics in the
was it
late
also
70s, early 80s.
Some kind of large hog?
He was like some kind of white trash guy who was, you know, threatening New York City or something. Had a real attitude.
I just want to point out again that you could have a garage sale to feed the entire world if you just emptied out Nick Gillespie's mind of all of his pointless cultural knowledge and vast and rich and wonderful that enriches all of us. All right, that's all the fun we're going to have.
Yeah.
The rest of this podcast is going to be grim.
Yeah, no.
Let's jump straight into it. As of Monday morning when we are talking here in the U.S. and A, Israel is still warning residents living in the northern half of the crowded and increasingly bombed out Gaza Strip to evacuate southwards in advance of a long-foreshadowed ground invasion to root out the power structure and military capability of Hamas, which has run Gaza since a one-and-done election in 2006 and has been sporadically killing Israelis ever since, including the horrifically savage surprise attack on civilians and concertgoers on October the 7th. The Israeli death count from that attack has risen above 1,400, according to government sources there, while the Gazan Health Ministry puts the death toll from retaliatory Israeli bombing north of 2,700. The Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, says that Hamas is holding some 199 hostages, from babies to soldiers to senior citizens, including in that number is 13 American citizens, estimated, on top of the 30 who have already been confirmed killed, the vast majority from that initial attack. Secretary of State Donald Blinken is back in Israel today after conducting shuttle diplomacy all over the region. The U.S. is trying to get Egypt to open its closed border with Gaza and take in refugees who are streaming southward. President Joseph Robinette Biden II has warned Israel not to engage in another military occupation of Gaza after they rout Hamas. Meanwhile, Israel is evacuating residents from 28 villages near the northern border of Lebanon, where Hezbollah has been sending rockets and there's been increasing military skirmishes. Iran has warned that a ground war in Gaza, which is definitely going to happen, could unleash a, quote, earthquake. The U.S. is sending a second aircraft carrier group into the eastern Mediterranean as an attempt at deterrence. And the Secretary General of the United Nations, who probably none of us except for Nick Gillespie could name off the top of our head, Antonio Guterres, said Sunday, "We are on the verge of the abyss in the Middle East." Happy Monday. Grim stuff all around, including some of the domestic discourse in the United States, which we'll get to a little bit later. Nick, there is no universe in which the U.S. is not intimately involved here as the chief military sponsor, not just of Israel, but a lot of the countries in the region. Obviously a close ally of Israel. We have millions of residents and U.S. citizens who have strong ties to that country, and on and on. What should, according to the Gillespie-lites, and you have, and I seconded last week, said that Israel has the right to remove Hamas next door. What should the U.S. be doing right now, and how do you feel about what we have been doing over the past week as a country?
I mean, I think what the U.S. has to do is, is stay out militarily. I think we could be working in various kinds of diplomatic, back channels and things like that. Although I don't think it's clear what is going to happen. And as I said last week, Israel not only has the right to go in and root out and find Hamas leadership, I think that, they have an absolute responsibility to their people and to the region. Hamas is just bad all the way down. There's no way to sanctify anything about Hamas at this point. And I think what the U.S. needs to do is to try to make sure that things don't escalate beyond the battle between Hamas, the Hamas leadership and the Hamas, soldiers or whatever you want to call them, and Israel. I'm not sure why I'm confident, but I am extremely hopeful, at least, that Israel is going to go in and they are going to use the, they're going to act according to the rules of kind of just conduct and war and things like that. This is going to be messy. It's going to be ugly. But I think as long as Israel defines its objective clearly, which is the removal of Hamas, and they achieve that goal relatively quickly, I think this does not need to become a major, global superpower, World War III type of scenario.
Speaking of that nightmare scenario, Peter, you are our resident nervous Nelly about global thermonuclear war and whatnot. Just want to gut check you here. How you feeling? And kind of specifically, what's your reaction to the now two aircraft carrier groups parked off the coast there?
Oh, it's double the fun, double the pleasure, like spearmint gum, right? I think is how that goes, right? I'm sure there's some like
hot twins.
The twins, right?
Double mint.
That's how it's going to go. It's going to be hot twins forever in the Middle East. Look, Nick is right that Israel has not only a right to go in and root out Hamas, but a duty. The purpose of Israel as a state is in some sense to protect the security of Israeli civilians, right? And that security was put in jeopardy by Hamas. If you leave Hamas in place, it seems pretty clear that there will be more incidents like the one we have already seen, and that is simply not acceptable. No state, no government can allow that. But this is not going to go well. There's no way that this goes well. I think the fantasy version of this looks something like this. There's a quick war. Israel takes out Hamas completely, or more or less completely. There are few civilian casualties. I don't think even the fantasy version includes none, but let's say there are a few civilian casualties. And then somehow in the aftermath of this, a peaceful, productive, rights-respecting regime that's kind of at least a little bit liberal somehow or another springs up. And there's cupcakes and ice cream and puppy dogs for everyone, hot twins all around, right? And that is not going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be something else, and it's going to be something bad. And I think, again, just look at the best possible scenario here is a whole lot of dead people and probably a whole lot of dead civilians. And that's going to leave, at minimum, even if there's no immediate violent repercussions, even if somehow or another this doesn't spread into a much wider war, that's going to leave a civilian populace that is understandably really mad at Israel. The Palestinians are not going to come out of this thinking, man, you know what, Israel, they had a right to do this, and that was basically fine, and they conducted themselves in a pretty reasonable way. Think of the historical precedents here. Every time a country goes in to another country, even with an absolutely justified mission to root out really bad people, And they go in and they kill a lot of people, and mostly they kill bad people, but sometimes they kill some civilians too. And it's actually pretty complicated because the bad people are deeply embedded with the civilians. That never, ever goes real well. And I just think I just think that the upside here, the best possible scenario, is still going to be a very bad one. And all of the other scenarios are much, much worse.
Catherine, I know that war makes you uncomfortable and you don't like that. Let's think about some of those people that Peter is talking about, which is to say, the refugees. Gaza, in many ways, is itself a refugee city.
It's not an open air prison as it gets described. It's a perpetual refugee camp, essentially, which is also, you know, largely on at this point on the backs of Hamas, not Israel or even Egypt.
So there has been a lot of diplomatic activity and discussion about Egypt opening up its border crossing. Certainly the issue of border crossings has been with us for a long time, just with Israel and Hamas. I think people, or Israel and Gaza, people have largely forgotten that thousands of Palestinians would come across the border on a daily basis to work in Israel. But what's your sense of what the regional players should be doing in terms of the refugees? And that can also include Israel and the U.S., but Egypt. What responsibility does the world have and do the regional players have in terms of the population that is fleeing southward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the particular relationship between Egypt and that population of people that has been in Gaza is explicitly political, which is one of the big problems. They are explicit about the fact that one reason they don't let those people into Egypt is because they will see that as kind of forfeiting their claim to Gaza, to a presence in Israel, that there's a concern that unless they are kept penned up in an eternal refugee camp, Israel wins. And there are a lot of other things going on, too. And many of those things are the same issues that face refugees all over the world, which is, well, how will this group of, you know, impoverished and displaced people change our culture? And what will it mean for, you know, how we think and talk about managing our borders going forward? But I think that it has been made very, very explicit over many decades that one reason that the neighboring countries, which are, you know, culturally similar and culturally aligned and should be able to accommodate the number of people who have been stuck in Gaza, the reason they don't let them in is because that would be admitting defeat. And that's not doing anyone any favors. You know, the problems are very real in every direction. But at this point, you know, people are dying because of the playing of politics with that population.
You know, Matt, you had asked about, you know, the U.S. and what the U.S. can be doing. And again, you know, the worst thing, and I said this last week as well, the worst thing that can happen is that the U.S., you know, interferes or intervenes militarily. This is a place where, you know, nobody talks about diplomacy anymore, but doing something with Saudi Arabia, UAE, and the other countries that are either already part of the Abraham Accords or about to become that, and kind of figuring out a way to manage or to keep Arab sentiment against Hamas and against Iran. Because this, you know, that is the whole function. If you talk to anybody about this, they say the whole function of the Hamas attack was to do Iran's bidding, to destabilize growing alliances between Israel and other regional Arab powers. And it really becomes a question of if the U.S. can do something productive, it's to make it clear that this is going to remain a conflict between Gaza or Hamas specifically, not Palestinians, Hamas and Israel. That probably is impossible to do. But as Catherine was pointing out, like Egypt, they're not letting any Palestinians in for all sorts of reasons, especially anybody related to Hamas. Jordan is kind of full on this count, et cetera. But that's something that the U.S. could conceivably be doing. It's very hard to believe that we have any diplomats or even the insight to do anything useful in the region, which is deeply,
it's not clear how significant our influence is at a point like this. But to the Biden administration's credit, all reports indicate that their message is basically twofold. We want to minimize to the greatest extent possible the number of civilian casualties. Again, even the fantasy version of this going as well as possible includes probably quite a few civilian casualties, but they want to minimize that. And then they also want to avoid escalation and turning this into a wider war within the region. And that is the correct message, even if, you know, who knows how effective they will be spreading that behind the scenes.
Let's shift to the domestic front, or at least the domestic discourse front, which has been the source of a whole lot of pretty raw debate. There were, after the October 7th attacks, some, I would say, objectively pro-Hamas rallies in some American cities and college campuses, with demonstrators, in some cases, sporting Hamas hang glider paraphernalia and graphics, doing the old from the river to the sea chant, whose literal application doesn't require a lot of extrapolation. There was a tremendous and still ongoing amount of energy spent dissecting various reaction statements from universities, or lack thereof, especially those who were pretty loose-tongued when it came to the Me Too movements and Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. Over the weekend, former Utah governor and former U.S. ambassador to Russia and China and No Labels heartthrob John Huntsman announced that his apparently super rich family will no longer be stroking fat checks to the University of Pennsylvania. He was writing in a letter to the president there that, quote, "The university's silence in the face of reprehensible and historic Hamas evil against the people of Israel is a new low." End quote. Penn had recently hosted a Palestinian writers festival that critics had charged was marred by various anti-Semitic sentiment. On the other side of the debate, a group of writers, including Ta-Nehisi Coates, who had been involved in a separate Palestinian literature festival, took to the pages of the New York Review of Books over the weekend to decry the catastrophe in Gaza, writing at one point that, quote, "On Saturday, after 16 years of siege, Hamas militants broke out of Gaza. More than 1,300 Israelis were subsequently killed." End quote. There's been a bunch of other related controversy. Aside from all that, Nick, I want to begin with you, both because of your UPenn ties.
I have no UPenn ties other than that I'll be giving a talk there on November 30th.
See, I'm just, that's, I'm a, proud. That's a
temple
set.
Owl.
Well, whatever. It's all
God, the what a gulf exists. I mean,
oh, but also because you let loose at some point over the past week a tweet, maybe two, I saw one, criticizing some fellow libertarians about the tenor and tone and facts of their response in the discourse. How do you feel about all this, what's happening on campuses, the reaction to it, the way that this stuff is being talked about, and kind of the spirit of cancel culture coming back into the conversation?
Yeah, which is worth thinking about. There's a lot of right-wing people who were against cancel culture 5 years ago who are now saying, you know, what we really need to do is to find the relatives of every idiot student who signed, you know, who belonged to a group who signed a letter saying that Hamas is great and make sure they never work again in America. That's just stupid. I'm disgusted by people who are celebrating the butchering and slaughtering of innocent people in Israel. I mean, and, you know, even Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, Hamas gets, you know, they break out of a siege and subsequently a bunch of Israelis die. Like, what the
happened?
Fuck is
certainly
that?
Certainly no causal relationship.
And, I mean, it was
going
to happen, but the timing is, you know, interesting, isn't it? You know, there's a sickness on the part of Americans who really don't even think or care about other countries. And it's just like it's playing, you know, Settlers of Catan or something like that. I mean, it's like a weird game, and it's deeply disturbing on a million different levels. For me, what I'm hoping out of this paroxysm of absolute, you know, just revolting stupidity on the left, and it's, you know, groups like certain chapters of Black Lives Matter, certain chapters of the Democratic Socialists of America, there are going to be a lot of people on the left who otherwise would have kind of gone along with whatever people like that were saying, or groups like that were saying, and they're going to be like, you know what, if that's what defines progressivism in America, I'm not that, and I'm moving to someplace else on the political spectrum, I hope. And they will become more thoughtful about not just this situation, but a whole host of kind of, you know, checklists, grievances, or, you know, attaboys that get added to every, you know, every time more than five people get together and talk about everything that's wrong in the world. In terms of the colleges and stuff like that, I don't, you know, there's a certain thing where if you say, like, you did not denounce the thing that I'm pissed off about quickly enough, so, you know, you are forever dead to me. I wish that colleges were radically different than they are now when it comes to, you know, actually being, you know, forthright, open, centers of inquiry and the production of knowledge and stuff like that. I don't care. I don't look to colleges to tell me how to live my life or to make statements about anything other than, you know, education. But it's appalling, and it should be appalling to everybody who has, you know, either half a brain or half a heart left.
Catherine, the work of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, which used to be In Education, always an E, fire. Over the years, they have always been defending professors and students from censoriousness and retribution for what they say and First Amendment activities on college campuses. Couple of the largest categories over the years have been if you are saying something kind of loudly, perhaps brashly, right of center or libertarian or just outside of the current. But another category is pro-Palestinian sentiment. Like, those are two of the largest ones. What is your sense of worry about a kind of backlash, a censorious backlash happening right now and the proportion of it?
I'm pretty worried about it. I come and go on the how, you know, where is campus censoriousness in my list of things to worry about. Maybe every time I see Greg Lukianoff at a party, it like climbs a spot or two, but who is the
head of fire.
So
it's like every 3 or 4 days.
So it's every 3 or 4 days. But obviously the folks at Fire do incredible work. I think the really important distinction, and one that Fire does a good job of honoring, is, you know, students and professors are on campus to think and talk about things and figure those things out. And they're doing that kind of live and in real time. And they might say things that they would later regret, but they're allowed to say them. But I have always been against the mandatory statement culture. Like, people could just not. Institutions could just not. That should be an option that is on the table, especially for something like this, where I think almost all of the commentary that I have read that I have thought is genuinely on point has been muddled. Like, if you are saying there's a clear and simple moral calculus and there's a clear and simple path forward, I just don't think you've thought very hard about it. And so, you know, it's really, really, really hard to imagine what to do that doesn't immediately step in some deep, deep, difficult moral problems in this region of the world. So it should be okay for Harvard to not have an official principal on it. Like, Harvard could just not say something. They could let individual students and professors speak for themselves. They could do scholarly work. They don't need to have an official statement. And I think there's a corollary to this, which is also the mandatory emoting about it. I got a little bit of feedback from my comments from the last podcast, and I think it was fair. Like, I just jumped right to, like, I'm trying to think about how to use property rights to understand what's going on in this part of the world. That's just who I am as a person. That's on me. But y'all did a really good job of the emoting at the beginning of the podcast, of the, like,
thank
I want to be
robot.
Clear what the feelings are and what the moral stakes are here. I skipped that part, and I think I did it because, to me, of course everyone's mad about the dead civilians. Like, of course they are. Of course they are saddened by it. Saying it over and over in a ritualistic way strikes me as unhealthy. Like, it's important to tell the truth, and it's important to say what you think, and it's important to think about these things. But I also don't love, like, in my Instagram feed, I follow Amanda Palmer, who is a kind of beloved counterculture, vaguely lefty musician gal. And she has taken like a rasher of shit this week for not publicly emoting on Israel's behalf enough. That's weird. That something's wrong there. I, you know, my inbox is full of emails from my family, from Israel, from my husband's family. You know, it's tough, but you shouldn't have to say that stuff out loud every single time. And especially if you're an institution, I think it would be, we would all be better off if, unless you have an active role to play, unless you have a moral obligation to do something, as many government actors do in this case, you maybe just don't say something. Maybe just sit and think about it for a little bit.
Can I tell a story about college kids or college? It's actually not about college kids, but it's about campuses.
You started. Keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So because I live in Washington, D.C.
You do?
I do. Several years ago, probably 6 years, 7 years ago, something like that, I was at a dinner of we're going to call this prominent Washington person. And there was another former prominent Washington person who became a very high-level college administrator. And there was, of course, some discussion about free speech on campus. And everyone was in favor of it. We talked for a while. This was a group of maybe 20-something people of a variety of political persuasions and, you know, sort of across the spectrum. And this college administrator, former DC person, was just talking about, you know, of course we're totally in favor of free speech, and it's just it's a really hard thing to uphold on campus, and you know, even the kids themselves are sometimes against it, and so many of the universities that I'm not affiliated with, they're doing it so badly, and it's really upsetting. But you know, the pro-Palestinian kids, I just can't with them. We just don't let them do anything. And, and this person just was like straightforwardly
admitted.
It was
like, okay to say that. Yeah.
That was the one exception. That was the one place where that their school went out of their way to be like, no, you can't say that.
It is wild to me how people are still out here saying the sentence, I'm in favor of free speech, but, and then saying something after the but. Like that sentence structure needs to be retired.
I don't think we should cancel college kids for saying stupid, awful, and offensive stuff. I think we should cancel them for being college kids. And that like not that no college kids, no, should be allowed to work in America. Only people who already are working, they should be grandfathered in. Otherwise only Matt would have a job still here because Matt's the only one who.
Matt was a college kid. He's just not a college grad.
I'm a college.
All right. So I mean college graduates here, right? Only Matt is the only person who successfully managed to get out of his like youth adolescence without a college degree. I almost managed, but somehow or another pulled it out at the end.
I think it's questionable if he's out of his adolescence.
That's also true. Yes. I would bet, and I would win the bet, that I am more in touch with and have created more lasting personal and professional networks with people I met in college than any of you bastards, because of the college newspaper that I worked for. So stick it, people. Nick, I'm getting post 9/11 vibes, and not in a good way necessarily.
Yeah.
About some
no, it's
some
terrible.
Of the discourse, let alone the policy. Set that aside. We've talked about that, and we will continue talking about it in future episodes. But after 9/11, there was a pretty massive public opinion tilting in favor of U.S. intervention, in favor, in support of George W. Bush, which. Just as a parenthetical, all y'all out there saying Netanyahu, he's going to benefit from this. Just please pay more attention to Israel politics. That's not how things work there, unlike here. There was this great simultaneous sort of like majority lopsided opinion and also a large amount of energy expended finding the associate professors of armpit studies at Eastern Colorado Community College.
They're contributing to basic scientific research.
Who said something stupid and risible about that. Do you worry about that kind of split? And I'm thinking this in terms of there's some polling that came across, I think, yesterday, just like huge majorities of Americans obviously are not just outraged about this, but support Israel in dislodging by force Hamas in Gaza. On some level, it's like, what are we even talking about here? Why are we hunting out heretics on campus, college campuses?
I'll say this. I mean, one is again, this could change in 6 months or something like that. But everybody, and I think even people in Arab countries, understand that, like, if you are the governing, if you're the government of an area and you invade a country and kill children and total civilians and things like that, the country that you have invaded, even if you are deeply, at the atomic level, anti-Semitic, that they have the right and the obligation to hunt down the people behind that and kill them and take them out of power. In the same way that we had after 9/11, a brief moment where the United States absolutely had the moral high ground to go after Al-Qaeda and the people responsible for the 9/11 attacks and hunt them down and kill them and remove them. And we squandered that. And this is actually one of the things that is deeply worrying to me right now, because, you saw some of this during the Ukraine war, where people, like, we had literally just gotten out of 20 years of completely disastrous and counterproductive foreign policy, as well as domestic policies immediately put into place in America in order to prevent the next 9/11, which were bullshit. And then people are like, oh, let's go into Ukraine because that's a good, clean, easy war. What has been bothering me more than anything else on a domestic level is the rehabilitation of America's response to 9/11 as if that was something good or, just from a pragmatic level, effective. And I think this would be an incredible moment for the United States to really go back and look at what we did in the aftermath of 9/11 and how quickly we overstepped what we should have been doing, and also how absolutely ineffective our responses to 9/11 were on the domestic front with things like the Patriot Act and all of the kind of cultural hysteria, Matt, that you're talking about, as well as the actual foreign policy implications that have, were disastrous. And we have just kind of like stopped even talking about that or thinking about that. And the retread of people like Condoleezza Rice and everybody else that they can get, including centrist, kind of neocon liberals, to start talking about how, like, oh, well, this is how we handled it and it was good. It's like, no, we don't, we should not be rehearsing our response to 9/11 in an American context as if it was anything other than an absolute disaster that we should never do again. But we're not even, we don't even
I agree with that.
Really casually trafficking in a lot of collective guilt, just on every single level, right? So, I mean, I know that I have seen, an uncountable number of basically the American left beheaded those babies type tweets, right? Like, just this, like, if at any point you were critical of Israel, you are personally responsible for the murders. And then, of course, vice versa. The desire to, we talk about this all, like, the desire to make this about us. Like, this is not about the United States. It is certainly not about the DSA. Like, the presence of a radical left in the United States is not our foremost concern here. I think it's perfectly fine to, have a conversation about who people should support and which side and the U.S.'s historical role in creating some of this situation on the ground. But it's not about us. And, there's the also internal to Israel, there's this, like, there are no civilians discourse, that which I think is really, really dangerous. The idea that, by being an Israeli, you therefore deserve whatever you get. That's, like, people are individuals, and it's important to parse people at the individual level, not at the everything that anyone you ever liked said is your fault and you should be accountable for it.
Yeah, if I may, that is a huge point that also, when that started cropping up, the idea, the defense that Hamas, of course, like a 3-year-old kid is as guilty as Bibi Netanyahu for Israeli foreign policy. That was redolent. Matt, you were talking about, you know, the various people who were ousted after 9/11. I was thinking of Ward Churchill, the University of Colorado professor who was the head of their Native American Studies concentration or program. I don't think it was a department, who famously wrote about the little Eichmanns who died in the World Trade Center, that to be, you know, a janitor in the World Trade Center on 9/11 was the same thing as being George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan or something like that. And that mentality, and there's a version of it on the right and the left, that needs to be confronted and beaten out of popular discourse and things like that. And the Churchill story, of course, had this weird afterlife because it turned out that he was lying about being a Native American and he ended up getting out.
A couple of lawsuits.
This is where, you know, tragedy, then farce, then something, whatever comes after farce. But yeah, it's a good moment for the U.S. to go back to our 9/11 and really kind of rethink all of the ways in which the government made unbelievably bad choices, and public hysteria really abetted it or even demanded
it. Nick is right to invoke the specter of 9/11 mistakes and errors, of which there were many. But I think the risk here is that even clean or just or narrowly tailored responses risk making things worse. There's a paper going around talking about how Israel has in fact had the capability to destroy Hamas for years and has decided not to. In fact, has decided in some cases to keep Hamas in power because they worry, with good reason, that something worse will spring up when you take out Hamas. And so I think, again, just to go back to what I said at the very beginning here, even the best possible responses, even the fantasy version of how this goes reasonably well, there is just the possibility for very bad things and very bad repercussions to happen here that will be with us potentially for a very long time.
All right, let's get to our listener email of the week. Reminder, send your queries via your email machines. You know, I was at a toy store yesterday, and they have these little new like pocket mini versions of old video games, like Galaga and like Mrs. Pac-Man in a little box. It was cool. I hadn't seen those before. So I was thinking about the email machines. Let's just get a little Minitel.
Is this Matt's Mitch McConnell moment?
It is. I had many points.
I would welcome a long and awkward silence at this point, actually. So,
yeah. No, just staring off into the distance. Poor Mitch. Anyways, roundtable@reason.com. That's how you get there. This one comes from a single first name only, Ben. It's a bold move, Ben.
Are you sure that's pronounced Ben?
Ben. There's no apostrophes. I didn't see. He stays on the topic that we've been talking about, even if the numbers are a bit out of date by now. Says Ben, as of writing this email, 14 Americans have been killed, murdered by Hamas. It's numbers now 30, I believe. Thus far, America's response has been fairly indirect, stationing a carrier strike group, going to be too soon, off Israel's coast, but not otherwise engaging Hamas. Is the principle of civis Romanus sum? Should I do more of an accent if you're going to be doing Roman or whatever, that Latin? Civis Romanus sum.
I believe it's a historical fact that ancient Romans spoke with British accents.
That is my belief.
And shouted a lot.
Yes. You know,
and, baritones only in ancient Rome, weirdly.
And every Native American is a Yugoslav and or Italian. is the principle of civis Romanus sum the concept that a Roman, or in this case, American citizen, can wander the earth under the protection of his, her, country's punitive capabilities, a legitimate guiding principle for U.S. foreign policy, whether in theory, execution, or both? Catherine, I realize that I interrupted the letter so many times that it's impossible to remember what was in it, but how do you answer the question, since at least you read it on Slack before we begin?
I'm just thinking about the Roman Empire, Matt. That's what I hear we do now.
Clap, constantly, clap.
More than sex.
So I think that this is... this is the kind of thing that's like a floating belief, but not an actionable policy principle. So like the U.S. wants to project the notion, hey, If you are a foreign power, or even really like a terrorist or some kind of non-state entity, and you were thinking about messing with some American civilians who happen to be in your country, it would be unwise for you to do that because we get really mad about it. Love the U.S. government. Like, that's a vibe that we would like to project. But of course, if you take that to its kind of formal, full conclusion, we immediately wind up in a disastrous mess, right? We are not, in fact, committed to extracting every American citizen from every problem that he might find himself in abroad, because sometimes it wouldn't be worth it. And so I think we get into this trouble all the time with foreign policy, right? Like, this is why foreign policy is so hard, is that you can almost never make a single absolute guiding principle and then stick to it all the time, or else you are just constantly triggering giant wars of all against all. I don't know. I think this is it was obviously not true of the Romans in the full and literal sense either. And it's not true of American citizens, but there is certainly some value in this vague sense that the U.S. takes care of its own. And I think that, it also leads people to behave badly. Like, I think we all remember stories about like college students in North Korea acting a fool, like, and finding out.
I said, cancel all college students.
No. Otto Warmbier did not act poorly in North Korea when he was then taken into captivity and, like, tortured to death.
Well, this is, like, maybe acting a fool is too strong. The notion that Americans sometimes take risks abroad on the sort of cinematic idea that the U.S. government will always come for them. So it may create some bad incentives. It certainly did in the case of Rome.
Nick, anything to add?
I would much prefer that American foreign policy be reduced to, Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi, who I assume is going to be the next Speaker of the House. You know, all of their job is fixing parking tickets for, American tourists in Uzbekistan or something. But no, this is this concept is wrong. It has never been observed fully, and it shouldn't be. There are times when the American government should absolutely stand up for this, and the early war with Tripoli under Jefferson, where American sailors were being impressed into service and or into slavery and things like that. Yeah, there's times and places for this, but in general, no.
I just like the idea of wandering the earth like Kane from Kung Fu, going from place to place, meeting people, getting into adventures.
It's not too late, Peter.
Getting into fights, slow motion fights, But by the way, I think he was actually a Chinese national. So it should have been the Chinese government that was protecting him every week when he walked into town and then ended up kicking the ass of like 15 guys.
I will say, as someone who lived abroad for 8 years, that the U.S. government does not care about you. Not at all. Even if you're like doing something like starting a company, they don't. Unless they can brag about you.
Well, they don't care about you.
No, about other people. I've met other people too, strangely enough. And that's generally not the purpose of a U.S. embassy. Like, if you lose your passport or get into trouble and you have to like deal with the U.S. embassy, and that happened to me once, that just the aggressive eye rolling and granted, I deserved every eye roll possible in the 1990s, as Catherine knows, but that's not what they're oriented for. They're conducting foreign policy. They're not out there to protect the estimated 6 million Americans living outside of the United States, which is a large and much maligned population. We'll also say, just for the sake of the overall thrust of the episode, it hasn't been receiving much attention. There's a lot of things competing for said attention, but there are an estimated 500 to 600 Americans in Gaza, not being held hostage, as far as we know. There's been some activity about evacuating Americans, I know, from Israel, and there's probably going to be some to evacuate some American citizens as well by boat, mostly. I would imagine that's going to happen from Gaza as well, but that is a dynamic that we don't know where that's going to lead. And as I think Donald Blinken said, or at least the White House or State Department spokesman last week, Look, we don't know how many there are. We're not in charge of them. We don't know exactly what the number is. So, you know, Americans, you're on your own on out there. So, no, that principle does not necessarily apply. Although, you know, when you start abusing large numbers of them, it is going to affect foreign policy. And I would predict that there's going to be more focus on this in the coming days if there are indeed a dozen Americans being held hostage in Gaza under warfare by murderous militants who have cell phones. That's a dynamic that I don't know if we're all prepared for. All right. We are soaking up the time here. So lightning round in the literal meaning of it. Peter, can you tell us what in God's name is happening with the hunt for a replacement for Andrew McCarthy, the deposed former Speaker of the House and so-called Bakersfield Comet? Who's going to be the House Speaker?
Andrew McCarthy, the star of St. Elmo's Fire and
your
Mannequin.
Your first name game has been terrible this podcast. Also, yeah,
Donald Blinken.
Former Hungarian ambassador. Is that who you were thinking of?
What's his real name?
Anthony.
Anthony? Yeah, Anthony Blinken. Can't. I'm
best known as the Mixmaster of Freedom, right? He had those great playlists of songs that he would release.
I'm just surprised we all got introduced with the right first names at this point.
So, exhuming McCarthy, Peter, is that what we're going to see next? Yeah. Who the hell is going to be the Speaker of the House?
So last week I suggested that Representative Jim Jordan, Jim Air Jordan, as they call him, the leg up on,
I hate you all.
He had the advantage going into this race because the hardliners were going to vote for him, and any group of five people can control the outcome of this so long as Republicans don't work with Democrats in order to elect the next speaker. Well, it turns out that moderates can play that game too, and it looks pretty clear that there are going to be at least five and probably more like 40 of the moderate faction who are like, Jim Air Jordan is not going to be our next speaker. So the question is then, who is going to be the next speaker? And my answer for you is, look, a blimp. There's no one has any idea how this is going to go.
My favorite possible guy is Kevin Hearn, who is known as Congressman McDonald's or McHearn because he owned a bunch of McDonald's franchises.
In my mind,
he's
the guy
from Coming
to America.
And there's no reason to
assume that that's.
Yeah, no, but I want a former like McDonald's magnate to be running the Senate, because it means if nothing else, you know, the play pit will probably be fully stocked and they'll be wiping down the tables in the in the House on a pretty regular basis.
The lack of a Republican consensus has now shifted the conversation to people speculating that there is going to be a bipartisan pick here, that somehow or another the centrist Democrats and the centrist Republicans are going to get together and vote for something like a coalition government. And I can't rule that out, like, because anything could happen here, and we really don't know how this is going to end up. At the same time, what that would mean is that some number of Republicans would have to vote for a Democrat, or some number of Democrats would have to vote for a Republican. And it's really not obvious that there is a sufficient group of Republicans who are willing to vote for any Democrat at all, or vice versa, for that to happen. Certainly not this week. We are not there yet.
30 days till the end of the continuing resolution. That's all I'm saying.
Great thing about continuing resolutions is you can always have another one. But you can't have another one with no speaker.
Lightning round, my man.
Mitch McConnell moment. My two words for you all is John Huntsman. Right? He's tanned. He's rested. Mm-hmm. He's ready. He's back in the game. Writing mean letters. No labels.
This can be his sequel. We can call it Huntsman Winter's War.
How are his...
That was the name of the Huntsman sequel.
His daughters... His daughters, the political equivalent of Girls Together Outrageously, Matt, are they back to sing him into office?
Is this
into
another
office?
Doublemint Twins reference? At any rate.
The Huntsman girls did a terrible, it introduced the era of cringe of the We're Bringing Huntsman Back video.
Once again, the contents of Nick Gillespie's brain enriching the universe. Mm. Let's go to our end of podcast brain enriching cultural consumption everywhere. I understand, I've heard rumor on the internet that Peter Suderman has been engaging in some deep thinking, cultural consumption and critiquing. What did you consume?
Heaven help me. I saw the Taylor Swift tour movie. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes long. And I think that is my review. It's just 2 hours and 45 minutes. It's of Taylor Swift having a concert in LA. It was interesting as a contrast because 2 weeks prior in the same theater, I believe the exact same like room in the same theater, I saw Talking Heads' Stop Making Sense, which is widely regarded as the greatest concert film of all time. And you know how long that movie is? 84 minutes. I'll leave it to you to determine which one I liked better.
My daughter might have been at that show in L.A. But she's on those are wow. Sweet 15 birthday present. Taylor Swift is obviously an American hero. It sounds like you loved it. Catherine, what did you consume?
I read the first book in the Masquerade series, The Traitor Baru Cormorant by Seth Dickinson. Somebody recommended this book to me. I think maybe even a podcast listener recommended this book to me, but I cannot find any evidence that that is the case in my various notes. Anyway, if it was you, thank you. This book is really good. It's also annoyingly timely. It's a very teeny smidge of magic, but mostly just it's a kind of quasi-medieval fantasy-ish politics book, court intrigue and the like. It's mostly about how territorial conquest and colonialism breeds rebellion and ultimately poisonous violence. So I don't know, feels a little relevant to the news at the moment. The quote that I brought to you, Reason Roundtable listeners, from the book is, "Freedom granted by your rulers is just a chain with a little slack." That's the vibe of this book. It's good. There's good outfits. Good. There's a sassy lady protagonist, but don't let that put you off the book. There's some, standard issue fantasy polyamory. It's good. It's a good book. And I will be reading the next one in the series, The Traitor Baru Cormorant by Seth Dickinson.
I think standard issue of fantasy polyamory is the name of your new Substack, Catherine, or podcast. Nick, what did you consume?
I watched Death Athletic, which is a techno-political documentary about Cody Wilson, the just absolute genius weirdo behind Defense Distributed and essentially the 3D printed gun movement. It's directed by Jessica Solce. I think that's how to pronounce her name, Solce. It's amazing. Cody Wilson is absolutely one of the most fascinating people on the planet within the broad kind of libertarian movement. He is working at a very high level to talk about questions and kind of structures of control. Zach Weismuller and I talked to him for 90 minutes a couple of months ago. We'll put that in the show notes. And Zach has also talked to Jessica about this documentary. Absolutely fascinating. And the title comes from the work of a German philosopher named Peter Sloterdijk, where it has to do with the idea of death athletes, people who basically give themselves up to death in order to further society in various ways. And just a really, really intense, great movie about one of the most fascinating people who's on the planet right now. Death Athletic.
Awesome. So Suzanne Somers, our great actress and Malibu residence and serial house burn victim, died sadly over the weekend of a long battle with cancer. I, 10 days ago, not necessarily as an homage to Suzanne Somers, because you can barely see her, but I saw one of the first movie that made her famous, which is American Graffiti.
Can I get Yeah, she's the girl in the
T-Bird. She's the blonde girl in the T-Bird that Richard Dreyfuss, a very, very youthful and Ben Dreyfuss looking Richard Dreyfuss, is hunting around. American Graffiti, George Lucas film, I think it's 1972 or ish, financed by Francis Ford Coppola, and probably among the most profitable movies ever made, arguably, I think the most profitable, just on return of investment scale, made for like $500,000 and made lots of money. Really interesting to see it after not having seen it since I was probably 19 years old. It was, I think, the first of the early 70s nostalgia exercises about 1962, right? There's just this like,
where were you in 62, man?
Can we please just leap over all that unpleasantness of the 60s? And that unpleasantness could be the Vietnam War, which has a little bit of echo at the very end of the picture when they're like throwing up like, oh, this, you know, this character died in Vietnam. Or it can be about race, or it can be about assassinations or whatever. I've always found, and I've probably mentioned this a time or two on the podcast, I've always found that sort of nostalgia, the throwback, especially in that particular time, to be sort of noxious. It's a way to erase and whitewash, sometimes literally, the recent past into an idealized kind of a better past, future, or something. That whole thing, you know, it spawned Happy Days, Richie Cunningham characters played there by Ron Howard in many ways, and Cindy Williams too. And for the next 8 years, that, which is my childhood, is just nonstop, like 50s, early 60s revival stuff, kind of ending in Animal House, I guess, was the last of those movies that did that, which is a fascinating period. But if you forget about that and just sort of rewatch it many decades later, it's a really interesting movie. If you like Cars, if you're a subscriber, and you should be, to Iowa Hawk on Twitter when he does this great sort of car ID things on the weekends, it's good car porn, people. It's just teenagers bored in Modesto or Merced, California, driving around on a Friday night. That's it. And the other takeaway is that Richard Dreyfuss, holy cow, this little kind of 5'7". Sort of lumpy character, just dripping with charisma, as David Lee Roth would say. Like, it's amazing how much sort of like weird energy he had for about 10 or 15 years there. And this is kind of the beginning of all that.
He is now an elder statesman who travels the country talking about the need to get back to the founding documents, Matt Welch.
Absolutely. I learned something about him. And I feel like I can share this. I learned that from someone who works in the industry. You ready for this? He refuses to drink Evian water. Do you want to know why?
It's French.
We do.
You would think there's some kind of French thing. It's because Evian, spelled backwards, is naive.
Wow. Matt, if I may, Mad Magazine parody of, American Graffiti, at the very end, Richard Dreyfuss catches the Richard Dreyfuss character catches up with the blonde and the white T-Bird, and do you know who it turns out to be? It's Ringo Starr, and it's like it's a joke. It's like, yeah, we're about to take over, like your world is finished. It's so brilliant.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
It's a
Mad Magazine movie parodies are just, I remember them much more than the actual movies, like Botch Casually and the Some Dunce Kid. I can
shampoo.
They were good through the 1990s. Yeah. I definitely was not old enough to see Basic Instinct in the theater when it came out, but I did read the Mad Magazine parody titled Basically It Stinks.
You know what is great about them?
Felt more like a lady than I do right now.
When you finally, because they're always about like R-rated movies that as a kid you couldn't see. And I know when I finally got to see all of these movies on VHS, I was like, wait, I have actually seen everything in this movie. Like in a 4 or 6 page parody, they nailed everything and added a critique to it. It was like, yeah, it's really beautiful.
There was a parody of one of the Death Wish sequels that was just like, well, in this case, he's getting revenge for his like second cousin's favorite, you know, kindergarten teacher's mom being mugged in, you know, Kansas or something. And it's just like has absolutely at that point, by the time you're at Death Wish 4, it has no relation to the original. And
Like a lot of movies of the 70s, in particular, Nick is the best in the world on this critique. It has some pretty messed up kind of sexual politics, even though it's, you know, it's benign high school version of it. But there's a long extended sort of set piece-ish thing where the hot rod guy has an underage girl who sort of sneaks into his car.
Paul LaMatt. We loved him in The Burning Bat, Matt Welch, later.
He was very, very good in this film. And there's like a lot of like weird sort of innuendo and fencing back and forth. And he ultimately acts with honor about the whole thing. But you sort of look at this girl and like, I don't know, that's just sort of like creepy. And she's too adult. And she keeps using the word rape, like, I'm not going to rape you. Are you going to rape me? And it's like, it's hard. And then you look at the credits and it's like a 10-year-old Mackenzie Phillips. And then you feel really bad about life. All right. That's enough bad life feeling about
Catherine
for one
is,
podcast.
Actually needs like a Narcan shot at this point. She is completely flat out on her back.
Listen, I'm going to have to do a Death Wish revenge situation here because you guys are going to kill her.
I know.
Avenge think I'm actually me. Part of it.
Catherine, I think, has admitted it several times in this podcast, whether explicitly or implicitly, that she is a robot. So she doesn't actually experience the feelings that she has right now of wanting to extract revenge. Thank you for listening, everyone. We'll be back next Monday, etc. Go to all of our podcasts, reason.com/podcasts. We also have tons of events. Some of them are podcasts themselves. Nick, do you have anything to advertise about your activities in the city of New York? Or actually, we should probably re-hype up. Is it too late to talk Posterel in D.C. here, Peter Suderman?
It is not too late. However, by the time you listen to this, it will be very, very, very close, or maybe too late. Look, this evening, Monday evening, October 16th, Jim Pethakoukas and Virginia Posterel are going to be at the new Reason office talking about the future and how to think about it, what to do about it, why it's awesome, and how we get there faster.
Awesome. Nick, any upcomings you want to point to?
Yeah, a week from today, October 23rd, Greg Lukianoff and Ricky Schlott will be talking about their new book, The Canceling of the American Mind. There are like maybe 10 or 12 tickets left. So if you're hearing this, go to reason.com/events and get a ticket as soon as
Greg
you can. It may be too
Greg
late.
Greg has been saying and writing many, many interesting things in the aftermath of October 7th and concerning all of the stuff we were talking about in the middle segment about campus and such. Go seek him out. Okay, that's all the time we have for again. I'll just keep saying that. If you like what we do here, go to reason.com/donate. Give us money. Helps us to do more of it. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.